It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Hey, everybody, it's Greg Gutfeld. I am super excited about my next guest. He's a biologist and evolutionary theorist, Dr. Brett Weinstein. He's a professor in exile from Evergreen because he offended the woke. But that's a long time ago. I'm more excited about his podcast he does with his wife, Heather Hying. I hope I pronounced her name right. I watch every podcast, and it is probably, I would put it up there in the top three or maybe even number one as the most entertaining, informative podcast that's out there right now. Congratulations on that, Professor.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You know, so I want to ask you this, because it's before I get into the nitty-gritty. In your life as a professor, how many students do you think you taught?
You know, I've wondered about that. It would be probably 500, something like that.
So now you have this podcast, which when I'm looking at it, maybe it has like 40,000. Sometimes I'm sure it gets over 100,000 on certain times. So you're reaching reaching a vast audience, and I can't help but think that whatever you're doing is pointing towards the future of education. Am I far off?
No, I think you're looking at something that's correct. There's definitely a vast hunger for authentic interaction and discussion. And there's also, I think, an awareness that the model by which we deliver education is economically preposterous, and that tuition is very high for no particularly good reason, and that the people that you encounter by paying that tuition may not be the best people to listen to. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I think people are discovering that they can source education more or less a la carte on the net.
All right. So I have to say, I mean, if my viewers or listeners haven't heard of the podcast, it's called the Dark Horse Podcast. And essentially, the professor and his wife, who's also a professor, it's a kind of a combination of knowledge, wisdom, and humor, and they talk about everything from biology to politics, and they're coming from, I mean, a history of progressivism, of being, you know, proud liberals, of Occupy Wall Street, but they're sane, and you're also, the questions that you get from your audience are also like, they're not stupid questions. It really is like the model for a course. Which is, does that make sense, I guess? I guess I'm just complimenting you.
makes a tremendous amount of sense. And the thing that might be hard to intuit is that when Heather and I taught at Evergreen was a very remarkable place. And obviously it went haywire in a very spectacular fashion. But part of the reason was that we had tremendous freedom as professors to figure out how we wanted to teach and what we wanted to teach. And so some of what's on the podcast is really a mode that we developed in our community at Evergreen and are now adapting to this much larger audience.
Mm-hmm. It's really natural. It reminds me of, when I was a kid growing up, it's like old school afternoon variety TV, but you guys are natural at it, and you've been working together and married, obviously. So there's obviously no issues with chemistry, but it's clever, and it's so much fun. For example, I'm going to talk. Before I move on, I keep talking about this in terms of Peloton. You're aware of what Peloton is, right? It's the exercise bike. Do you know what that is?
I know what a Peloton is, but I don't think I know about this exercise bike.
It's okay. So what it is you buy the bike, you get instructors that are beamed into your screen at home. And what they've done is they've combined exercise with charismatic instructors. It's like once you get a bike, you are addicted to it. You lose weight. It's fantastic. You show up every day. I do it every morning. And I keep thinking that is the model for the future of education. And when I'm looking at your podcast, what you're doing is you're what Peloton did to the gym. You perhaps are creating a model for the brick and mortar schools. It's like you don't have to go to the gym anymore and you don't have to show up in a class anymore. If you've got the right instructors and the right venue and the right equipment, I guess is what I'm babbling about. I don't know.
Well, I'm still a fan of riding my bicycle outside, but nonetheless, I get what you're saying. And I agree. There's something about refactoring the educational model so that it fits your life and so that more of your time is spent thinking about the sorts of things that are productive and interesting,
yeah,
and less of it is wasted on busy work.
Yeah, so true. And one of the topics you were, I was listening to you, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, and you were talking about dreams, and I am obsessed with dreams. I find it like it's a funny topic because nobody likes to hear other people's dreams, although they like to tell people about their dreams. Because whenever you get in a conversation with somebody and they start yakking about their dreams, it's like I don't care. But you come to work and you had this insane work dream and you have to tell everybody, and you were talking about your a theory on why, I think somebody had asked you, is there an evolutionary purpose for dreams? And you kind of posited this idea of it almost like being a dry run for real life. And it made me think about the fact that when I let my driver's license expire, I had dreams every week of driving without my driver's license and getting into certain situations with police officers. And I had to figure out my way out. This dream played over and over and over again. And I couldn't figure out why until you kind of explained it. And go ahead if you can explain it, because I find it fascinating.
Sure. Let me just say that the study of dreams has been hampered by an evolutionarily preposterous take that has lasted far too long inside of the discipline of psychology, where people have imagined that dreams might be random firings of the brain, you know, little snippets from here and there that show up for no reason, which makes no sense. The brain is a tremendously expensive organ to run, just energetically. And leaving it completely offline would be cheaper. Therefore, that which it does, while it could be offline at expense, must be paying its way. So the hypothesis that I was talking about has to do with scenario building and mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, our brains are built to take in information from the world and process it in real time. But mm-hmm. because we are diurnal creatures and because our eyes function well when there's a lot of light and not so well when it's dark, we have all of this time with this very fancy computer on our shoulders that doesn't have anything productive to do with respect to taking in new information. And mm-hmm. so the mind runs through possibilities that will be encountered and tries them out so that they are not new when you first encounter them. So your example about the cop pulling you over is an excellent example of something you might encounter. And I can tell you from experience, if you roll down the window angry because you haven't thought through the incentives of the officer, you're very likely to get a ticket. Mm-hmm. And if you can fast forward your way through that anger, which you might learn in a dream, mm-hmm. you roll down the window and say, "Yes, officer, how can I help you?" You're much more likely to get a warning. Yeah. So there's a lot of benefit to be had for a person who's mind productively uses that downtime to try things out.
It's so interesting because when I finally decided to go get my driver's license renewed, because in New York, if you let it expire, you got to take the actual driver's test again, which is just horrible. And then when I did it, the dreams are gone. All of the panic dreams about, like, sometimes it would involve, like, a relative that's sick and I have to get her to the hospital, but I can't because I don't have a driver's license. All that just went away. It was amazing. It was as though the brain was waiting for me to solve this problem before it was going to let go of it. You know, it was doing its job, basically harassing me into finally going in and getting my driver's license. You know?
Oh, I think this is right on target. And you said up front that nobody likes to hear other people's dreams. I do. And I used to actually ask my students to tell the class about the dreams they had. And one of the things that I discovered in these exercises was that our dreams do not look alike. Mm-hmm. So my dreams, for example, are always first person. I'm always looking through my own eyes. Mm. That is not universal. There are lots of people who have dreams where they sort of look down on a scene in which they are present. Sometimes people have dreams in which they are not even present, which mm-hmm. I find amazing. But to your point about your dreams about your license going away as soon as the problem was no longer a threat, I had this exact experience with the fear that I would show up to a final exam in a difficult course without having been present for all of the instruction.
Oh, God, I get that one. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I get that.
Well, here's the thing. I was a sketchy student. I was, some classes I did very well, but I always struggled with other ones. And at the point I graduated, that literally stopped. It went from a regular occurrence to zero. Mm-hmm. I haven't had that dream since, which does reflect exactly the hypothesis in question, which is at the point this is no longer a risk, there's no point in wasting your mental energy on it.
Yeah. There was that it's that reoccurring dream that you found out you had a class at the last minute, or you're in college and you don't know where the auditorium is. I have these and I'm 55. I will still get the I'm not sure where the auditorium is. And it's always I went to Cal. So it's like I'm running around Berkeley and I don't know where it is. And I'm like and I still have that. People have work dreams like at Fox, like they're going to be late for a show but this is it's very strange to have that. Now, you also that was funny. My producer, when we were walking over here, she used to own bars in Hell's Kitchen, and she her dream was running out of ice. You know, it's always about something that has something to do with your responsibility or what's expected of you. And it was like she actually had these disturbing dreams that she didn't have enough ice at the bar, which is a good concern to dream about if you're a drinker, I think.
Well, I don't know. I mean, running out of ice, that's kind of hot.
Terrible. See, it's puns like that that make your podcast so endearing. But you also brought up something which, okay, so about, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years ago, or maybe not that long, I was trying to get an expert on lucid dreaming because I used to lucid dream maybe 30 years ago. I was in college 35 years ago, and I was having hypnagogic nightmares. So I'd be like paralyzed. And I would have this kind of like animalistic, almost gargoyle-like creature either at the foot of my bed or really close to my face. And it was terrifying. I would get these twice a month. I used to get them as a kid. And then I talked to some dude who was a therapist. I don't know how this happened, but he basically gave me some tips on how to address it before you go to bed. And it was basically some kind of self-talk and basically trying to wake yourself up in this state by telling yourself it's a dream. And it's like before you go to bed, you tell yourself it's only going to be a dream. And then when it happens, and so miraculously, like over, it happened. And I was able to wake up while dreaming and vanquish this beast. But what happened, the consequence or benefit of that is now I could do that in almost every dream. And which creates like these incredibly strange adventures. And but anyway, to the point is I tried to look for a lucid dream expert. I couldn't find a single person. I found there was a guy who wrote a book on dreams, but he wouldn't come on the show, I think because it was Fox. That was his nightmare. But you mentioned it, and I thought that was – I was like – and I was curious what you thought – what is going on there that allowed me to do that? Also, the fact that it is now – fairly difficult for me to try it. It seems like it's a muscle that you have to practice, and you can lose it over time. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. In fact, I've had the same experience. I used to lucid dream. I taught myself to do it with a technique I picked up from the Stanford Sleep Research Center, mm-hmm. and I quite enjoyed it, but it was also quite exhausting. And so I stopped doing it at some point.
Yes.
But, you know, I learned a bunch from it. I learned that although I control my own actions in the dreams. Mm-hmm. I don't control other people's actions in the dreams, or if I open a door in a dream, I don't control what's beyond it.
Right.
You know, I could do things. Oh, this is a funny one. I'll probably regret saying this out loud, but I learned that I could fly, mm-hmm. but I never figured out how to do it without flapping. And so it was a tough job staying in the air, and it usually ended badly. I would crash land and wake up. But anyway, yes. Yeah, so you ask why you're able to do this. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is this: your conscious mind is involved in your dreams. You are mm-hmm. conscious within a dream, but you're not conscious of being conscious in general. Mm-hmm. And at the point that you lucid dream, you become your waking consciousness mm-hmm. is involved in your dream, which tends to be very jarring and wake you up. So the technique involves figuring out how to stay asleep at the point that you suddenly are aware. But what I would argue is the reason that you dream is because you do productive work in that state. In general, your waking consciousness does not need to be directly aware of what took place. And in fact, maybe it's not even positive for you to be aware of it, which is why we don't remember our dreams. But every so often, that's not the case. So I will have the experience every so often of I will wake up from a dream naturally, you know, not with the alarm clock, but I'll wake up from a dream and I have the sense that my unconscious sleeping mind is handing the conclusion of the dream off to my waking mind so that I will have it available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it could be, oh, I don't trust this person the way I thought I did, or, you know, look out for this hazard that I hadn't been expecting, but it's a handoff. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm getting at is the relationship between your sleeping mind and your waking mind has to be flexible in order for the many things that dreams do to function to your benefit. Mm-hmm. And so what you're effectively doing is you're hacking that border mm-hmm. and you're bringing your conscious mind across it so that it can be present in your dream state. And there are lots of good reasons to do that, but your ability to do it has to do with the fact that the gate is not absolute, so that you have mm-hmm. Room to adjust it.
And in that kind of like, when I look at it that way, there's, and you were talking earlier about things that you can control and not control. What I always noticed with the lucid dreaming is that there is the part that you can't control will sabotage certain things that you want to do. So like if you are walking down this street in a dream sequence, you're walking down the street and there's a beautiful person that you wish to be romantic with. That person, as you get closer, can turn into something horrible. And I always found that to be the case in a lot of lucid dreaming, is that there was always still some kind of conscience or something there that was keeping me from being a jerk. I don't know.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, you have to ask the question about whether or not that circuit, whatever it is actually wisdom mm-hmm. getting in the road to prevent some other part of you from leading you into a regrettable danger.
Yeah. Or just committing any kind of crime and wondering if it, like, there would, like, I'm going to rob a bank, but am I really awake or is this a dream? And it would be really stupid if I thought I was lucid dreaming, but it was actually reality. I've actually had that thought in a lucid dream where I go like, wait a minute, this might not be a lucid dream. Don't be stupid. And then that would be my kind of that other like little safety that would go on. And then I would just not rob the bank. Because generally when you first lucid dream, you think, you know, I'm going to commit all these crazy little crimes. I'm going to fly. I'm going to turn over cars, blah, blah, blah. But all right. I think I've exposed myself enough to my mental problems. I want to talk about Unity 2020. Okay.
Sure.
This is a really phenomenal idea, especially since the ticket that you've come up with is kind of ingenious. But I want you to explain what Unity 2020 is, and then if you want to talk about the ticket that you decided on and why, go for it.
Sure. So Unity 2020 is now a fairly substantial all volunteer organization that was hatched after I unveiled an emergency proposal for recapturing the White House for the American people. Mm-hmm. And essentially, I just realized that I was very disturbed by both the major party offerings, and that I thought it actually put the nation in danger and that we needed another way. But I know from years of experience that if you propose something outside of the major parties, you are always told that you will elect the greater evil, and therefore you mustn't consider it, and especially not this election cycle. So to beat that argument, I came up with a proposal that does not spoil an election. And the proposal involves drafting two candidates, one from the left and one from the right, drafting them under the agreement that once elected, they will govern as a team by consensus, except where that is impossible. The person at the head of the ticket will be chosen by coin flip. After 4 years, their positions will reverse, and it goes on this way until somebody has inhabited the office of president twice and is no longer eligible, at which point somebody else could be swapped in, and it could go on indefinitely. And this tends to do a couple things. One, because it appeals to people on both the left and the right. It does not clearly empower one side or the other. And we now know from our organization that this actually works, that we draw evenly from would-be Trump and would-be Biden supporters. We also, quarter of our volunteers actually are people who weren't planning to vote at all. So we're very attractive to disaffected voters who are so fed up that they're no longer engaged in the process, and our proposal brings them back. And I guess the final thing, you asked about the ticket. And so we went through a process in which people nominated people for our draft. It turned out that the top six people were far enough away from the rest of the pack in terms of the number of times they were nominated that they constituted a good short list, three from the left, three from the right, just as it turned out. And we then ran a ranked choice vote for, we set up the nine possible tickets with three from the left and three from the right. And we had our membership go through a ranked choice vote, which worked beautifully. And the top ticket is Tulsi Gabbard and Dan Crenshaw.
Yeah.
The second one is Andrew Yang and Admiral William McRaven.
All right. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
I remember the second one, which I wasn't that crazy about, but the first pair is, I don't think you could do a better job of selecting two independent thinkers from different sides. Obviously, they're both veterans. And Tulsi is just, to me, just, you know, when I look at her, and I even, and I'll say this about Crenshaw too. I've talked to him a couple of times. Penn Jillette said this one thing. He said that he's always interested in people who, when they give you two of their political or social opinions, you cannot predict the third one. And I think that you can say that about Tulsi. Like, she could tell you what she believes in two things, but you still aren't really sure what she would, if you did a third one, what she would believe in, because she marches to the beat of her own drum. And Crenshaw obviously is an incredibly appealing and refreshing voice, and especially when it came to how he dealt with the cancel culture, refusing to cancel Pete Davidson over the joke. And the joke that I think Crenshaw understood was that the joke is a joke by virtue of being horrible. And so it's not, that's the whole point of it, that it's a horrible joke. But anyway, so you have these two people. Let's say you end up qualifying. I'm not sure how you qualify. You might be able to explain it to me. What happens? You draft them, and I mean, I'm pretty sure Tulsi would be all in, but would Crenshaw be all in? I don't know. But my point is, how do you get to that point?
Well, first of all, let me say, let's just take a moment to notice that an institution or an organization composed of patriots who just simply volunteered for the job was able to put together a process in which, absolutely without our meddling with it, it produced a ticket this good.
Yeah.
And the ticket's even slightly better than than you are saying, or maybe even know, because it turns out that Tulsi and Dan know each other and they're friends. So not only did it find a ticket that you know, checks all the boxes, but we know that these people get along well enough to actually do the work of finding a consensus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I couldn't be more pleased at how well the process accomplished what we wanted it to at that level. Mm-hmm. From the point of view of the draft, what we need is a groundswell of support. And I think this is maybe, if there is a weakness of the proposal, it is this, because people are still traumatized by the idea that they will be blamed for spoiling the election. Right. And so although privately we get lots and lots of support and enthusiasm and people telling us to keep going and make it happen, publicly they're not ready to say so. And that will ultimately require us, by our own agreement, to pull the plug on the plan if we can't get it to to catalyze. So this is something, it's a tragedy for the nation if we have to do that, because we really do have something that's so superior to the major party offerings. I mean, just imagine, put yourself in the mindset of it being January and Tulsi Gabbard and Dan Crenshaw are being sworn in under an agreement to govern together in the interest of the nation. I mean, how much better do you feel about our prospects in that scenario than either one of the major party candidates winning?
You know, it's 60 days away, and I feel hopeless in the sense that unless Biden wins big, and I'm not saying I'm pro Biden. I find the whole idea of him being the nominee atrocious, especially when they had the opportunity to, they've had 4 years to figure this damn thing out, and they give us a guy who is kind of literally on his last legs. But anyway, so what worries me is unless it's a landslide, we're gonna have violence. And I guess what bugs me about my own thinking in this is that I wouldn't mind another. There's a reason why I wouldn't. Like Trump, I could live with, except I couldn't live with the violence that people seem to be hanging over the country's head if he does win. And that I don't want to be thinking like that. I don't want to think that my vote has to be a certain way or else there's going to be bloodshed. But there are forces that are making me think that way. Believe me, I understand Trump's faults, but I also see he's done some things even this week that the critical race theory thing. I mean, these things to me are not small. They're like things. This is why a non-ideologue is so interesting. But I'm getting off track. I think the genius of your idea is that people can vote for it knowing that they're not going to benefit the person they like the least. That's how this is what I think is so interesting about it, is that, you know, if you know, I were to vote, it's not like I'm going to help Biden, because there's somebody over not voting who's going to vote for this that's not going to help Trump. So, do you see my point? I don't know.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. Now, I will say, just so that the picture is complete, I'm expecting, if the unity proposal does not catch fire as it needs to, and we're condemned to choosing between Trump and Biden, I believe Trump is going to win by a substantial margin. And that is going to result in a catastrophe predictable enough of one kind. But I think we've got to protect a catastrophe of another kind coming if Biden wins. So what I want people to understand is that the very fact of voting for president itself requires you to suspend your disbelief. We all know that your vote is infinitesimally likely to affect the outcome.
Right.
And yet we are depending on tens of millions of people to calculate that it is still worth doing. So we're already doing something that is hard to explain in voting.
Yeah.
And explaining why you would vote for Tulsi Gabbard and Dan Crenshaw instead of Donald Trump or Joe Biden is the same kind of calculation, right? It's a little hard to defend, but in the end, it's obviously right. And if only people could say, you know what? What the heck? The proposal is constructed not to elect the greater evil. This is a far better option than either of the major party offerings. So I'm going to do it. If people would do that and then talk to each other and say, you know, hey, you ought to join us, this could actually happen.
Yeah. You know what? I know it sounds so cliched to say this, but the person that needs to have you on is Rogan. But I know you've been on his show before, but it seems like if you want that kind of like, what do you call it, groundswell or the, you know, to come from below, because it's not going to come from above. It's not like the top networks are going to grab this. It's when you have somebody. I'm surprised Rogan hasn't. Has he tapped you on this yet? Because I don't know. Feels
Rogan
like
Rogan and I. I think it's fair to say that we're friends. I certainly like Joe. I've been on his program 5 times, and in fact, I unveiled this plan before it was called Unity 2020. It was called the Dark Horse Duo Plan. And I unveiled it on his program where he was enthusiastic about it. So, yes, I agree. He is a uniquely positioned and I think overwhelmingly trusted and liked leader. Mm-hmm. And that, yes, his embrace of the proposal would put it in a whole different league.
Yeah, and you get that it's like a mimetic response. All these everybody else falls in line. If he does it, then other people do it. And all of a sudden, it's like, then all of a sudden you have producers at networks going, hey, did you hear about this Unity 2020 thing? That's how it works, sadly. I want to ask you, because I don't have much time left. I got to go put my makeup on my face. okay, so you were the canary in the coal mine with what's been going on, I think, from Portland to Seattle, Olympia, you name it, Wisconsin, starting with, you know, what happened to you. But so you're seeing this happening all over the country. When I'm saying these protests, quote, protests that are 93% peaceful, which is, it's like saying your life raft is 92% non-leaking. Where do you see this going?
Oh, I hesitate to tell you, Greg, because I think this is just an unmitigated disaster. Yeah. And I will tell you, yes, I do feel like the canary in the coal mine, because it looks so much like what happened at Evergreen. And I, at this point, I'm forced to conclude that I went through it for nothing, because we're just repeating it at a scale that's, you know, I mean, it was predictable enough. When I testified to Congress, I told them to expect this. And some of them listened, some of them didn't, but yet here we are. So where is it going? Potentially, we're headed towards some new version of civil war. Yeah. And I'm concerned that it might be headed our direction much faster than people imagine. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if you're watching the resignations of even black officers or black heads of command over BLM, and you're watching just the recruitment numbers down, there's going to be a wider gap of non-policing, and that means you're going to see more of these demonstrations that are just unfettered. And I don't know if you talked about this or if I was thinking about it, but I was thinking about RoboCop, and I'm thinking about how this is. I think it might have been you, but how, or maybe it was Scott Adams. I'm getting my podcast confused, but the kind of the lurching towards privatization of security is going to be that's what's going to happen, and only the rich are going to be able to afford it. And so the police, in a way, will become like the postal service, in that only inner cities will rely on the postal service, where everybody else does DHL and FedEx and UPS. And this is how the model of law enforcement might end up being, where you're in a gated community or you're in a town that has a really strong, well-paid private security, where all the good police end up going for better pay. You're going to end up having these kind of this public utility and this private and this incredibly successful, effective private thing. That seems to me where it might end up going in about 5 years. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah, that was me. Yeah. I can't. I don't know if Scott Adams might have said it too, but yes, I think we're headed towards gated communities, mm-hmm. private security, and then for those who can't afford those two things, it's going to be warlordism, mm-hmm. the Wild West. It's going to be an absolute tragedy, and this is also needless because, yeah. as flawed as the nation may be, it was a stunning success as a prototype, and the right thing to do is to fix what is still not quite right with it rather than to wreck it in this absurd, nonsensical overreaction.
It's whatever the organization is doing, which I find interesting that we don't know the exact numbers. Like if you could guess the jelly beans in that jar at the counter of the diner, how many people are vandalizing and looting? Are we being held hostage by 5,000 people, 700 people? No one's counting.
Oh, it's amazing. And what they've done, it's an incredible magic trick, really. They have pretended that they are speaking for a vast majority, and they've created this illusion by terrorizing people into being silent. Mm-hmm. And so by conflating their silence with support for this nonsense, they're absolutely deranging the process. And we're, uninventing the police, even though if you ask people, irrespective of color, people don't think that's a good idea.
Right, exactly. And what happens is the smartphone can capture exactly what the activist or the rioter wants captured, which is the police responding. And so then that creates the second and third guessing of law enforcement, because you're going to have to react with force at some point, and force is ugly. Smacking somebody, with a baton is going to be viral, and you might get fired. So it's almost like they are handcuffed by the smartphone, and every politician is frightened of losing their power over this, so they can't stand up. I mean, if you didn't care about whether you were going to be reelected, you would put your foot down and stop this. But the mayor of Portland just wanted to be liked,
And the irony is, he's not going to end up being liked by anybody.
Yeah,
the rioters hate him, mm-hmm. and all of the people who are depending on him to put an end to these riots are going to end up hating him for failing to do it. So it's a completely needless political catastrophe for him. But somehow he just can't see past his own rhetoric.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. Let's end on an up note. Do you see a way out of this? Just lie if you have to.
No, I'm with you. So let's put it this way. In evolutionary theory, mm-hmm. use this metaphor, what's called the adaptive landscape. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the adaptive landscape is that we are on a peak. And in order to get to a higher peak, a better state, we have to go through what we call an adaptive valley. And so things look very dark. Mm-hmm. Now, it could be that's because we're headed towards the dissolution of the country. Or it could be that very darkness is the frightening pathway to something better, that we will wake up in time and that we will do the right thing. And if we do that, it is possible that we could come out stronger than we are now. But wow, I hate to have to risk it this way. Mm-hmm. It's such a beautiful society, and the aspiration is exactly right. And for us to threaten it this way is just it's frightening. So let this be an adaptive valley, and let's find the higher peak on the other side.
I like that. I'm gonna use the clumsy analogy of, like, it's just like the Cold War before communism fell. It all looked really bad. I always thought that we were gonna get nuked, and then it didn't happen. That's how I'm gonna look at it. Probably not a good one.
Well, let's hope that's a good analogy.
Yes. Professor Weinstein, a pleasure talking to you. Obvious stupid question. Where can people find the Dark Horse podcast? When does it air? You've done like 45 of them.
Yep. They can find us on their favorite podcast app, or if they want to watch us, they can find us on YouTube, and they can also get announcements at on Twitter at Brett Weinstein. Brett has one T, or at Heather E. Hying, H-E-Y-I-N-G. Those are probably the best places.
She's hilarious, by the way. Very dry sense of humor.
I love her.
Yeah, you guys do good. You guys are like the, you're like the George and Gracie of evolutionary biology.
I'll take it.
I don't even know if anybody listening knows what I'm talking about because that's such an old reference. But George Burns, Gracie Allen. All right, great. Thank you, Professor. Awesome.
All right, thanks so much, Greg. Nice talking to you.
Same here. Bye-bye.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.